Step behind the curtain as renowned private investigator Sheila Waisaki unravels the truth behind real, tragic deaths that just don't add up.
Leading up to the final episodes of this season, The Verdict, you have been taken into the courtroom for each stage of the civil trial in the Jonathan Cruz case. You heard us serve an 11th-hour subpoena to the forensic lab in Dallas, which resulted in last-minute evidence being brought to court. You listened to opening statements, expert witness testimony, Brenda pleading the fifth, and most importantly, you heard from Jonathan's friends and family. Today, you will hear the verdict and final judgment.
Here is Sheila and Tom Shaw.
Tom, how are charges given to a jury and who decides what is given to them, what's written? Do both attorneys have to agree?
No, each side presents their version of the jury charge and the judge decides which version, if they're different, sometimes they're pretty similar, which version of the jury charge is presented to the jury. The most important issue in this case involved how the judge was going to instruct the jury on the defendant's use of the Fifth Amendment to avoid answering questions that I asked.
I didn't realize that. I actually thought G had to agree with you on what was given to the jury.
No, she went with me on everything. The issue is whether or not there's enough evidence to support asking question to the jury. And in the case of the Fifth Amendment, I thought we had the better argument. We presented a trial brief to Judge Montgomery that set forth what we thought the jury instruction should be on the Fifth Amendment.
Is that before the trial then?
Well, we presented the brief before the trial began, but it was in anticipation for the time when she'd decide how to instruct the jury, because she could have instructed the jury at the time that she took the fifth or immediately thereafter. But in this case, I think she correctly decided that as part of the jury instructions, that she would read that instruction to the jury about the jury may, but doesn't have to infer the negative about her taking the Fifth Amendment.
So I have some questions for you, Tom. Did the jurors ask to review any evidence while they were deliberating?
Yes, they had several questions. One of the first question was where the gun landed. And that was important because if he would have shot himself the way G anticipated or tried to argue that Jonathan shot himself, the gun wouldn't have ended up where it was, which was right beside, I believe, his left thigh. And it would have been on the floor. So I do remember very fondly that worried me. And Sheila and Danielle said, oh, no, that's a good sign, because they're really thinking this through, as, you know, they should be. And that's a good sign for us. If you'll recall, the second question was, what did Mr. Shaw ask for each of the line items? And we knew then that we had a jury that was going our way, because Judge Montgomery correctly pointed out and, you know, ran it by us before she wrote it down. Basically, you're to remember what Mr. Shaw said. What he said is not evidence. It's merely a suggestion on what the jury should award. And fortunately, in this case, the jury either misremembered or remembered and wanted to give more. And I don't necessarily believe that they didn't remember, because they may have thought, Shaw, you're an idiot. You asked for too little. Because if you remember, I asked them to tell the truth, which was that Jonathan was murdered, and acknowledge his value to the Cruz family and quantify that loss. And they did a darn good job of that. I mean, that was probably for the Cruises, I don't know which was better, the acknowledgement that he was murdered or how much the jury assessed his value to his family was. And that's the way I wanted to frame it, because it's hard to frame it in the exact manner that the law wants us to, like the idea of pain and suffering and mental anguish and all that. I argued that, but really it's what's the whole thing worth, and then work backwards from there. That was kind of, and I wasn't entirely comfortable with those large amounts, but I thought it honored them.
I'm comfortable with them.
Right. We just to show you though, if you recall, we got, you know, that verdict, I think, was the seventh or eighth largest verdict in the United States.
Tom, you mentioned time was important. At a certain period, while waiting for a jury, if it's before this time or after this time, it was significant. Do you want to go through what that means?
Sure. Generally, a defense verdict is pretty quick. It's no liability, and then you don't have to fill in the damages. So if you're, the way it usually happens, and my experience in the way it happens, is the jurors, first of all, have to relax. They have to pick a jury foreman, which takes a few minutes. Then the jury foreman reads through the charge and either anonymously or asks for the jurors to raise their hands if they think the answer to question number one is yes. And I suspect on that there was no disagreement.
So what were your thoughts about the time that they spent deliberating?
The longer they stayed in, Danielle, the more confident I was that they were working very carefully through each of the questions. I thought maybe they were caught up on something, probably damages, that they were having some level of discomfort with what I asked for. But as it turned out, that was not the case.
And so what was it, about three? It was a little under 3 hours that they deliberated for?
I thought it was 2.5, but because we left there, I want to say 7:30 or 8, as I recall, and they went out at 5 or 5:30. It's always very dramatic when the bailiff comes out and says, jury's back, because your heart stops. Because, you know, I've been in enough trials where, you know, it didn't go my way. And that's very, very disheartening. And the client is obviously very disheartened in that situation. But the last couple of trials I've been involved with that are larger, fortunately, they went our way. And this one went our way in a big way.
Pam's amount, like if they awarded John $5 million, they gave Pam $10 million.
Pam was very sympathetic. I think that it came through that Jonathan was very special to Pam, and that his loss probably left an empty hole in Pam's life that they wanted to fill with letting her know that her son had great value. And the only way they could tell her that was to value his life in a way that shows her that her son was valuable and that his life was not, in their eyes, he didn't die in vain.
I'm going to say this also. I think it's a way of a jury saying, we heard you.
Yes, that's a great point. That's right. We heard your testimony and statements about Jonathan, and we agree with you. We, as a matter of fact, we think he was even more valuable. It was a team effort. It truly was. I mean, without that video, it doesn't personify him. It doesn't bring him to life. That was brilliant. And it really broke the trial down into three parts. Her, how bad she was, introducing Jonathan via the video, and then filling it in with all of the witnesses that came after the video, because it really ended up magical.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The final verdict was $206 million, which was
right.
About $100 million more than you had asked for.
Right.
Correct?
Correct. Because, you know, a hundred and some odd million dollar verdict is a big verdict.
Yeah.
Especially in Dallas County, those are the kind of verdicts that happen down in the valley and in Morris County and the more plaintiff-oriented parts of Texas.
Brenda no longer lives in Texas. Does that affect the ability to collect damages?
Yes. And it makes it difficult if you want to initiate collection efforts in whatever state she moved. And in this case, she moved to Missouri. And the collection laws are unique to each state. In Texas, you can't garnish wages. Other states, wages aren't necessarily off the table. I'm not an expert in that area, but I have some familiarity with with some jurisdictions as far as collectability. And collectability was an issue here because she didn't own anything of any significance to our knowledge. The judgment will be domesticated, and as a result of that domestication, it's as if a Missouri court issued that ruling.
Many people are under the impression, Tom, that once a verdict comes in, a $206 million verdict, that Brenda has to either write a check or make restitution of some sort. How does that work?
Yeah, it's unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, we don't have debtor's prison, which means that while she has a $206 million verdict in Texas against her that resulted in the judge entering a judgment for $206 million that's now probably $250 million, she doesn't have to pay it. If she can't do it. And of course, as I said, she doesn't go to jail, but you have to, the the client and or the lawyers have to initiate collection actions to collect on that judgment if they want to be paid. Oftentimes, there's insurance involved, which there was not here, so that once the client, in our case, the Cruises, got a judgment, they would then get the insurance, the benefit of being the beneficiary under the policy, and direct that the insurance company pay the Cruises whatever the value of the policy is. And then that offsets however much it offsets of the judgment. If that, in other words, if it were a $1 million policy, the insurance company would pay $1 million and the judgment would now be, say, $249 million.
What you're basically saying is Brenda walks out of that trial and has still no responsibility to the death of Jonathan.
Other than having the scarlet letter of being a murderess, that's correct. But she still has to live with herself, and she has to live with a husband that sat through that trial and can't have been deaf. And if you recall, we I think it was during final argument, I pointed over to him and said, by filing this case, the Cruises may have saved a life. I pointed to her husband, Mr. Kelly, and the jury got that.
Yeah, I will say, as somebody who heard that in the trial, I would not want to be sleeping next to someone after hearing all of that evidence, because at what point do you think something might happen?
Yes. And to have heard testimony from John that she's going to do it again, that the police said that to John and Pam, that she would do it again, would be haunting.
So, Tom, tell us about after the verdict. What happened next in the courtroom?
Yeah, usually it was a long week. And usually the jurors are anxious to leave and get on with their lives. In this case, it was very, it was unusual in a very positive way, because they lined up, I think it was all six of them, because this was a six-person jury and instead of 12, since it was county court at law. And they were very, very interested in why this case wasn't being tried as a criminal case rather than a civil case. Because we made that very clear during voir dire and opening statement as far as the burden of proof is concerned. So they were outraged that this wasn't being prosecuted as a criminal action. And they were disappointed as well. And that was very, very satisfying, because like I said, I it was important to me to let them know that this is it for the Cruises. They don't get a chance in criminal court, and they don't get another chance in civil court in 20 years when their son should have been getting married or having had grandchildren. And because if you remember the testimony of everyone was Jonathan wanted to be a dad. If Hollywood could ever make a young man who whose life was vindicated in his death, it would be Jonathan. Because, you know, he became quite a man at the end of his life, and he was finding himself and finding his footing at the very time when his life was extinguished.
Question one. A person commits an assault if she, one, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes bodily injury to another, two, intentionally or knowingly threatens another with imminent bodily injury, or three, intentionally causes physical contact with another when she knows or should reasonably believe that the other will regard the contact as offensive or provocative. Bodily injury means physical pain, illness, or any impairment of physical condition. Did Brenda commit an assault against Jonathan? Answer yes or no. The jurors answered yes. If you answered yes to question one, then answer the following question. Otherwise, do not answer the following question. Question two, did Brenda's assault against Jonathan proximately cause the wrongful death of Jonathan? Answer yes or no. The jurors answered yes. Question three, a person commits aggravated assault if the person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes death or serious bodily injury to another and uses or exhibits a deadly weapon during the commission of the assault. Deadly weapon means one, a firearm, two, anything manifestly designed, made, or adapted for the purpose of inflicting death or serious bodily injury, three, anything actually used by the user in a manner making it capable of causing death or serious bodily injury, or four, anything that the user intended to use in a manner that, if so used, would make it capable of causing death or serious bodily injury. Did Brenda commit an aggravated assault against Jonathan? Answer yes or no. The jurors answered yes. Question four. Negligence means failure to use ordinary care, that is, failing to do so, that which a person of ordinary prudence would have done under the same or similar circumstances, or doing that which a person of ordinary prudence would not have done under the same or similar circumstances. Ordinary care means that degree of care that would be used by a person of ordinary prudence under the same or similar circumstances. Proximate cause means a cause that was a substantial factor in bringing about an injury and without which cause such injury would not have occurred. In order to be a proximate cause, the act or omission complained of must be such that a person using ordinary care would have foreseen that the injury or some similar injury might reasonably result therefrom. There may be more than one proximate cause of an injury. Did Lazaro's negligence, if any, proximately cause the wrongful death of Jonathan? Answer yes or no. The jurors answered yes. Question five. Do you find by clear and convincing evidence that Brenda's conduct was committed with malice or gross negligence? Clear and convincing evidence means the measure or degree of proof that produces a firm belief or conviction of the truth of the allegations sought to be established. Malice or gross negligence means an act or omission by Brenda, A, which when viewed objectively from the standpoint of Brenda at the time of its occurrence involves an extreme degree of risk, considering the probability and magnitude of the potential harm, and B, of which Brenda has actual subjective awareness of the risk involved, but nevertheless proceeds with conscious indifference to the rights, safety, or welfare of others. Answer yes or no. The jurors answered yes. Question six. What sum of money, if paid now in cash, would fairly and reasonably compensate John and Pam for their damages, if any, resulting from the death of Jonathan?
Without Warning Podcast, available now on all major podcast platforms.